Carolinas are being swamped by these heavy rains and high winds from Hurricane Florence.
The best scientists in the world are all telling us that our activities are changing the climate.
I don't think it's a hoax. I think there's probably a difference, but I don't know that it's man-made.
Experts say that we have until 2030 to avoid catastrophe.
Father of two children that's very frightened of their future.
How old are your children?
They're 10 months and 4 years.
Can you see a picture? Those are the picture of your children?
Yeah.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alny with To The Point. In New York, in London, Berlin, and other cities this week, a radical arm of the climate change movement kicked off 2 weeks of planned protests. It's called the Extinction Rebellion. The tactics may be considered extreme, didn't get a lot of coverage, but the name has brought new attention to an issue raised on Trevor Noah's The Daily Show by the 16-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg.
We are right now in the beginning of the sixth mass extinction, and people don't know these things. Up to 200 species go extinct every single day.
The Sixth Extinction is the name of a book by Elizabeth Colbert. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a contributor to the National Geographic. She's written the text to accompany photos of extinct or endangered species called vanishing. That's in the National Geographic. Elizabeth Colbert, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your book, The Sixth Extinction, has a subtitle. It's An Unnatural History. What does that mean?
Well, you know, as you'd surmise from anything that's the sixth, the reference is to five major mass extinctions in the history of multicellular life, so going back over the last 500 million years. And the fifth is the extinction that did in the dinosaurs and a lot of other major groups of organisms, I should add, and that was about 66 million years ago, and the general consensus among scientists is that that was caused by an asteroid impact. And so the notion of the idea of a sixth extinction is, are we as Greta said, on the verge of another mass extinction events. Extinction rates today are very, very high, hundreds, perhaps thousands of times higher than what is known as the background extinction rate, which is the extinction rate that has pertained over, you know, most of geological history.
You write that if, in fact, we had only the background extinction rate, we would hardly ever see species go extinct.
Right. Extinction rates are very, the background extinction rates are very low. During the course of a human lifetime, you know, and certainly in any given place, a human should not see any organism go extinct. Now, it's true that nowadays we have, you know, sort of global communications, but nevertheless, you should not be able to see all sorts of, you know, mammals, to name just one group, either going extinct, on the verge of extinction. That is a tip-off that something very, very unusual, and I would add also very dangerous, is going on.
If there is a sudden cause of mass extinction, such as the asteroid 66 million years ago, what is it this time around?
Well, this time around, as many scientists have said, this is not sort of an original idea, but you know, the asteroid is us. We are changing the planet very, very fast. Once again, a lot of these things seem very ordinary to us on a sort of human timescale, but when you look back through the history of life, things that we're doing right now are extraordinary. One of them is we're pulling up fossil fuels out of the ground. Those are fossil fuels that were created over the course of hundreds of millions of years, buried a lot of carbon underground. We're now combusting it, putting that carbon back into the atmosphere over a matter of centuries. So we're taking a process that took, you know, hundreds of millions of years to run in one direction, and then over in a matter of centuries, we're running it in another direction. So we're sort of running geological history backwards and at a very, very high speed.
What are some of the other practices by our species that are causing other species to go extinct?
Well, the unfortunate truth here is that there are many of them, but to focus on some of the what I think would be considered the, you know, the biggies here. We're simply mowing down a lot of habitat. You know, when we cut down a forest, especially a rainforest in a part of the world where there's, you know, tremendous biodiversity, there's simply, when you think about it, nothing, nowhere for those creatures to live. So that's habitat loss, habitat fragmentation are major, major drivers of extinction right now. We're simply, you know, killing animals. There's still a lot of over-harvesting of in the oceans. There's poaching on land of animals like elephants and rhinos, highly endangered right now. Several species of rhino, for example. We are moving things around the world. So, you know, most over the course of most of the history of life, if you were a species that evolved in North America, you didn't leave North America. Now, with global trade and global travel, things are traveling around the world constantly. And when you bring species together that have evolved separately over many, many millions of years, you can get some pretty nasty surprises. So there are a lot of pathogens that are causing very significant mortality. A frog pathogen, for example, that's been moved around the world, that's driven a number of species, no one knows exactly how many, to extinction. Invasive species, especially on islands where species are not used to predators, you introduce a rat or you introduce a cat or a fox, and you can very, very quickly drive a species to extinction. So these are all big, big causes of extinction right now.
Greta Thunberg said 200 species are going extinct every day. Is that accurate?
Well, I think that those figures are very, very hard to verify because there are two things going on right now. One is that we don't really know how many species there are on Earth, even to an order of magnitude. We've named and identified, you know, about 1.5 million, but there could be, you know, 10 times as many species out there. And then the second thing is that the vast majority of species on Earth are invertebrates, right? So they're not, you know, big, you know, mammals that we watch cruising around the landscape. They're insects. They're, you know, mollusks. So we don't have a very good track record on tracking little tiny creatures. Now, that being said, those figures come from a calculation that's done about how many species, you know, sort of occupy a given area, and then when you mow down the rainforest, you're changing the sort of the area, and it's an extrapolation from that. And whether that is, you know, accurate or not is really, really hard to say right now.
So there are these many, many species, more than we actually know. Why is it so important when one or another of them goes extinct?
Well, I think there are, you know, several different ways to answer that question. One, obviously, from the perspective of the species, you know, that's the end of the line. We have a species is, I compare it in that piece to a manual. Every species is sort of a one possibility, one answer to the question, how do you live on planet Earth? And when we eliminate a species, we're eliminating that answer. That species is never going to re-evolve. So we're destroying an archive of life, and we're doing it really quickly. Now, if someone went in and just, you know, burned down the Library of Congress, we'd all be very, very upset. But out there every day, we are in effect doing that.
Aren't these species all dependent on one another? And if one species dies, does that mean that others are in fact at risk as well?
Well, in many cases, you know, almost certainly yes. And there are, you know, species that are sort of considered keystone species, sort of architects of the of ecosystems. And, you know, there are definitely, we know that when, you know, the American chestnut, for example, which was a dominant tree in the northeastern forests of the U.S., when that basically has been eliminated owing to an imported disease that was imported from Asia, you know, probably almost 100 years ago, that when the chestnut, you know, died off, a lot of species that depended on the chestnut, you know, insects and various other creatures also went out with it. Now, there are, you know, probably species that you could lose without having a huge ecological impact. But once again, these are things that we as humans who are not sort of participating in those food webs, it takes a lot of very, very careful study to figure out what's happening. And unfortunately, in most cases where species are going extinct, we really don't know what the knock-on effects are.
You talk in an article I read recently where you were interviewed about how just in the past decade, two mammal species have gone extinct. One was a bat and the other was a rat. Why should we care about the bat and the rat?
Well, as I say, there are a bunch of different ways to answer the question of why should we care. One is simply, do you care, you know, do other species have a right to exist, and are we, you know, mowing down really the diversity and variety of life on Earth that's taken essentially billions of years to get to this point, and we're sort of heedlessly eliminating it? Is that, do we consider that acceptable on an ethical level? And then the, if you say, well, I don't really care. I didn't care about that bat. I didn't care about that rat. What's it to me? The next point I guess I would make to bring this, you know, closer to home is, if you look at these major catastrophes in the history of life, I don't think you would have wanted to be around for them. The survivors, you get, you know, into these sort of extinction cascades. That gets back to your question of, do species depend on each other? And even though we like to think of ourselves as sort of independent from, you know, nature in its raw state, we are obviously still organic creatures. We're products of, you know, billions of years of evolution, and we depend for everything we eat on the products of evolution, and we are dependent on various biochemical and geochemical processes, whether we like it or not, and we are mucking around with them at a very profound level, and that is what these extinction rates are telling us. So I guess the other point I would make is, look around you. If a lot of other species are winking out, it's probably a sign that something, as I said, something pretty dangerous is going on.
Aren't we, though, as a species, very fortunate that there aren't any dinosaurs anymore?
Well, I think that most, you know, paleontologists would probably agree that dinosaurs were the dominant group of organisms on the planet. They when they shuffled off this mortal coil, that left space for mammals.
They didn't shuffle off. They got eliminated in a big hurry.
Exactly. You're right. That left space for mammals who were pretty insignificant, pretty small at that time, you know, going back 66 million years, to kind of creep out of their little burrows and become the dominant group on planet Earth. So, you know, yes, we definitely, as it were, do owe our place in the history of life quite probably to that extinction event. Now, you could look forward 66 million years and say, you know, eventually our elimination, you know, will lead to some other group becoming the dominant group on planet Earth. And if that, you know, makes you feel better, you know, okay, that's probably true.
What do you say to people who claim that by all of the changes that we have made, whether it's agriculture or the bringing up of fossil fuels related things, of course, or the other things we have done that have been destructive of other species, are in fact good for us because they have made the planet more habitable for us?
Well, I think there is a tremendous tension there. That's exactly, you know, that is exactly the problem. There are right now 7.7 billion people on Earth. Obviously, that's more than there have been at any other time in the history of the planet, certainly. It's, you know, twice as many as there were, more than twice as many probably as there were, you know, just 50 years ago. We consume a lot of resources to keep 7.7 billion people, you know, fed and clothed, consumes a lot of the planet's resources. And I don't think that one should deny that, you know, agriculture and even, you know, burning fossil fuels have, and also I should say nitrogen fertilizers, synthetic fertilizers play a huge role in this. So changing the nitrogen cycle on the planet, those are what have enabled 7.7 billion of us to be here right now. But that doesn't mean that we don't have a big problem on our hands right now. for precisely that reason.
Is there any potential benefit to us, to the human species? Does anybody suggest this is okay?
I have not encountered the person who says this is really okay. Yeah, I think people, you could argue that we're all acting as if it's okay and we just keep going and doing exactly the same things that are causing this massive loss of diversity on planet Earth. But I think if you sit down and talk, I've not met the person who says, oh, I just think this is hunky-dory and there's nothing to worry about.
So why do you think we act as if it's okay?
Well, I think it gets back very much to what you were saying. We are, you know, creatures of all of these. Our societies now are dependent on a lot of the processes that are causing other species to wink out. And we need to confront that, in my view, head on and say, what could we do to reduce our impacts while at the same time feeding, you know, and clothing 7.7 billion people, which is no small order. It's not easy to figure your way out of this. And it also isn't easy precisely because it has multiple causes, as we were discussing before.
Once again, we're talking with Elizabeth Colbert about the current edition of National Geographic called Vanishing. Back with her in a moment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point and Elizabeth Colbert of The New Yorker, who's written about some magnificent photos of the many species that are vanishing. That's the title of a National Geographic edition by that name. There are magnificent photos of birds and pandas and monkeys and other creatures that we're traditionally sentimental about. But Elizabeth Colbert, you're focused on a particular tree snail shown leaving its slime as it moves along. Why is that so important?
Snails in many parts of the world, Hawaii, this islands of the South Pacific, you have these really interesting snails that arrived on these archipelagos and then speciated out, sort of a very interesting example of evolution in action, just as Darwin's finches, you know, arrived in the Galapagos and speciated and are sort of textbook examples of how evolution brings us variety. And these tree snails, that particular species is one of many, many endangered species that have been endangered actually by the importation in most cases of these other snails that unfortunately decided to feed on these snails. So you have all of these, you know, many, many varieties of snails on these islands that are highly endangered. Some exist only in little terrariums right now. And there are big efforts to try to reintroduce some of them into their native habitat. But these are really, really laborious efforts because these invasive snails are still out there, you know, chomping their way through the forest.
Does a lot of this introduction of invasive species have to do with international trade?
Well, in many cases, yes, absolutely. Many invasive species, exotic species, are introduced inadvertently. People didn't intend it. They just hitchhiked along with cargo. But in some cases, and this is an unfortunate story with some of the snails, in some cases they were purposely brought over, in some cases to eat something else. So you have many cases where something was brought over for biocontrol, you know, it was going to eat some pest that we didn't want. But instead of eating the pest, it often ended up eating a lot of native species. And I would say that people have gotten a lot more careful about purposefully introducing non-native species, but we are still, in fact, the introduction of non-native species via, you know, just, as I say, trade and travel is only increasing.
So, we got those photos of snails that you like so much. We've also got frogs and birds and a lot of other vanishing species. Tell us about the photographer, Joel Sartore, and how this all came about.
Well, these photos are photos that Joel has been taking of animals in captivity. He started this project many years ago of basically photographing, trying to photograph sort of every species that's in captivity, I believe. And the species that are in this month's edition of National Geographic and in a book that Joel has published that I wrote the foreword to, these are species where in some cases the species, the individuals that Joel photographed were the last known examples in their kind. They've been taken into captivity in many increasing numbers of cases now. You know, animals have been taken into captivity in a last-ditch attempt to save them through captive breeding programs. And in some of the cases where this did not work, you know, Joel has actually photographed the last known individual. I know that's the case, for example, for a frog called the Rabs fringe-limbed tree frog, which was native to Panama, and a few were collected in an attempt to, as this disease, this fungal disease that I mentioned before, was sweeping through Panama, and a few of these frogs were collected. They were new to science at the time. The captive breeding program did not succeed, and the last known individual was nicknamed Tuffy, and he lived in Atlanta at the Botanical Garden there. And when Tuffy died, he actually had an obit in the New York Times because it was such a sort of beloved and well-known, and it was such a sad moment to see him go, see the whole species go.
The picture of Tuffy has his arms out and makes him look like he's flying. Was he a flying tree frog?
He probably was a very, very good leaper. Yes, the Rabs fringe-limbed tree frogs were really interesting species. They laid their eggs in these tree holes, you know, which in the rainforest are filled with water. And then in an amazing, amazing evolutionary quirk, the dads would stay with the frogs, with the little tadpoles, and literally sort of let the tadpoles eat off their backs. And that's how the tadpoles got their nutrition. And then when they grew up, you know, yes, they probably were good at leaping through the canopy of the rainforest. They probably didn't, even come down to the ground very often, if at all.
You did a lot of research for your book, The Sixth Extinction, and you've done a lot since, traveling the world. Tell us what the point is. Why are you doing this, and what have you discovered?
Well, I guess why I'm doing this is it seems like we are living in an extraordinary moment in time, and that's true. You know, if you look through the long history of life, we are living in one of these moments where the diversity of life is contracting, and contracting really fast. And people, and we're the cause of it. We're not just seeing it, we're the cause of it. And it seems to me that if there's anything that people ought to be aware of right now, this is probably it. And so the point as a journalist is simply to go out and record and chronicle what's going on in the hope, I suppose, that we can ameliorate the worst effects of what we're doing. How's that?
We think of ourselves, or we talk of ourselves often, as the highest form of life on Earth, and yet you're suggesting that we may also be the most destructive form of life on Earth.
I don't even think that's really up for debate right now. We are the dominant species on Earth. There's a lot of talk these days about whether we should rename the geological epoch that we're in. And this is talk among very serious geologists, the Anthropocene, to recall the Anthropocene, because we have become basically the dominant force on planet Earth. And unfortunately, our impacts on other species are, except for those species that we've domesticated and which are doing very, very well. And then if some species that do well with humans, rats and cockroaches and species like that, for most other species, our reign so far has been, pretty tragic. So I don't think there are really many other candidates for most destructive species on Earth. And it's not, these things are not necessarily, they are in intention, thinking of ourselves as the highest form of life, and also thinking of ourselves as the most destructive form of life, but as the most intelligent form of life on the planet, we should be able to get our minds around that before it's too late.
How does this all relate to climate change?
Well, as I suggested, I mean, climate change is one of the ways we are changing the world, you know, on a geological scale. So we have increased the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere over the last, 100 years or so by more than the change that you would normally get between an ice age and a non-ice age. So that's a very, very significant change. And carbon dioxide, you know, has the unfortunate property of being a greenhouse gas. It traps heat near the surface of the earth. We're warming the earth. We're warming it really fast. It's not clear that there's ever been a moment where this much CO2 on an annual basis has been released into the atmosphere. So we're conducting what's been called, once again, this is not my phrase, you know, a vast geophysical experiment without knowing what the impacts are going to be.
So we adults of the world aren't doing a lot to reduce the consequences of what you refer to as this experiment. And now we're hearing the voices of young people. They're worried about their futures.
I think Greta Thunberg says it best, to be honest. I wish I were as eloquent as she is. You know, we kind of have to grow up. And yes, there's a lot of scary news on all fronts right now these days. And climate change in particular is very daunting and intimidating and frightening. But we can't say that does not allow us to just, you know, stick our heads ostrich-like in the sand. It really means we have to face up to the fact that, you know, damage is being done and we need to try to minimize that. And as I say, I think that requires us to be kind of grown-ups as opposed to little kids. And it's embarrassing, honestly, that a 16-year-old young woman has to be the voice of reason here.
So when and if we really confront this, we're going to have to make a lot of changes that are almost too difficult to think about when you consider what it'll mean to actually stop the process of climate change before it gets so bad we can't control it at all.
Well, I think that you know, that daunting quality of it, you know, is debilitating. I certainly don't deny that. But I think that one important thing to realize is we could make enormous strides, really enormous strides here without people's lives changing radically at all. Now so we should be moving, you know, first to do those things that we know how to do and that are relatively simple to do. And we should be doing them, you know, as fast as possible. And that is, you know, transitioning off of fossil fuels. And we now have forms of power, you know, solar power, wind power that are really just as inexpensive as fossil fuels, and we should be changing our energy infrastructure. We should certainly not be adding any more fossil fuel infrastructure right now. That's just insane. But, you know, to actually get to the point of zero emissions is very difficult. But before you take even the very first step, you shouldn't complain about how difficult it is.
So you're really encouraged by what these young people are doing.
Yes, I do think that's very encouraging. And my hope is, you know, traditionally, certainly at least in the U.S., young people have not been a crucial voting bloc because they simply don't vote in the same proportion that older people vote. So I really hope that in addition to being out on the streets, and there's, you know, a lot of great energy out there, I hope that they will be going to the polls and really punishing politicians who have been not just not doing anything, but many politicians actively spreading disinformation right now. In the U.S., we have a situation where, unfortunately, one party has become committed to, you know, a huge disinformation campaign, and that's just got to end.
Has the other party been offering real programs to deal with the issues that you've defined?
Well, I would say in this presidential round, we have seen most of the major candidates come out with some kind of plan on climate change that what you can certainly criticize, you know, many of them, all of them, but they would all be a significant step in the right direction. How's that? And I think that is a first, and that should be somewhat encouraging as well.
What about those parts of the world where practices are taking place that are actually making climate change worse, such as the situation now in Brazil with the Amazon?
Well, I want to say the country that is making climate change worse, is us. We are making climate change as as much as the Brazilians are. We are still responsible for way more of the world's emissions than the Brazilians are. So, I think it is the height of hypocrisy, really, for us to, say, well, the Brazilians are the problem. Now, that being said, Bolsonaro, not unlike Donald Trump, scoffs at a lot of the science of climate change and argues that, make Brazil great again. And you see the results of that have tremendous global ramifications. The loss of the Amazon rainforest, which is sometimes called the lungs of the planet, could have really devastating repercussions globally. So if the U.S. were in a position of leadership here, perhaps we could A, lead by example, and B, have some sway with the Brazilians. But right now, since we ourselves are moving backwards on so many fronts, the Trump administration is not just, not making progress on climate change, they're actively trying to roll back whatever progress was made under the Obama administration. So we are not really in a position to tell other countries what to do.
When the problem is global, it seems to me that nationalism is contrary to the possibility of solving the problem.
Yes, absolutely. And this is a moment when we need really profound global cooperation to solve what, as you point out, is a global problem that can only be dealt with meaningfully on a global level. And is it a coincidence that right now, we are seeing resurgent nationalism? If there are historians around, a century or two from now, I think they will look back at this moment as a moment of sort of maximal madness, the way we look back at World War II.
On the other hand, when we talk about this issue of how difficult it is to cope, and when you think of it globally, it seems absolutely beyond your control. But are there things we can do? You talked about the possibility of changing the kind of fuel that we use and going to the polls and voting. But what about individual actions? And isn't it necessary for people to feel that they're making a difference?
Well, I don't think it's ever realistic to think, when you say the global problem, that your individual actions are going to make the difference. Now, that being said, I certainly think that we all should be doing those things that, if globalized, would make a difference. How's that? And that, means reducing our use of fossil fuels, for example, reducing our consumption in general. All of these, everything that we buy, that we consume, all of these things have, large clouds of carbon behind them. So yes, we should all be looking at our own individual lives, absolutely. But if your standard is my giving up X or Y, going to save the world, if that's your standard, then obviously you're going to fall short there. So I don't think that's an appropriate standard.
What's next for you? You've written in The Sixth Extinction. That's a book you put out a few years ago. You won a Pulitzer Prize. Now you're contributing to the National Geographic, and you've written written copy for its latest edition called Vanishing, and also supplied the text for Joel Sartori's book, The Photo Ark, which we have discussed briefly because it's got these wonderful pictures. What are you going to do next?
Well, I'm working on another book. How's that?
Okay.
So I hope we can talk again when that's done. Not quite finished yet, though.
And you're not going to tell us what it's about?
It is sort of a follow-up. Let's put it that way. It's about the ways that we are changing the world.
All right. Well, come back and talk to us if you will, please. We'd love to have you. And thanks for being with us this time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This To the Point Climate Change Update was produced by Andrea Brody with theme music from Chris Wotherspoon. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetary. I'm Marvin Olney. Later this week, check out our To the Point podcast on Republican silence about the evidence for impeachment and why is Ukraine the source of scandal here in America? And don't forget to let us know what you think and what issues you want to hear more about. Give us a shout on social media. On Twitter, it's tothepoint_KCRW. You can reach me at warren.olney@kcrw.com or tweet me at warrenolney1. Thanks for listening.